lost an episode.
Oh, no.
Remember that? Yeah, we have to go talk about that because we said we would.
Ah, Jesus Christ. Okay. We're bringing up painful memories here.
Okay, so as the listeners may notice, it's been a while in between our last episode and this one. Because I guess it's my fault because it crashed. It was my computer that crashed. But we did record an episode on the one-year anniversary, or about the one-year anniversary of Anthem. And then we lost all but 8 minutes of my audio. And so we just had to scrap the whole thing. I think we were already kind of like punch drunk, punchy a little. I don't know what you want to call it. About how basically there was nothing happening with Anthem. So we were just complaining for about an hour. And we didn't really feel like recording it again. So I guess here is our rundown of what we just talked about for that hour. Which
today
was,
is Anthem's birthday.
Yeah, it was like Mark Dar tweeted, and I quote, "Today is Anthem's birthday on Anthem's birthday," and that was like the highlight of Anthem's birthday. The seasonal stuff was just kind of lackluster. The short stories were some were okay, some of them were not, and some of them broke my brain because of how I don't want to say stupid, but it's somewhere up there. Some word like that because of how clunky. That seems nicer. Clunky was.
Yeah.
I think that was about it.
I think anyone that watched the live stream that I did recently, that was actually on the actual anniversary date of Anthem. I basically, if you didn't see it, I started off streaming Anthem, and then I became so frustrated with the server and sort of like the idle thing that booted me out when I stopped moving for like 60 seconds. That I ended up switching to playing Mass Effect Andromeda. And kind of what I said on that stream is pretty much my thoughts currently. Like, the Christmas lights are still up, right? Like, the ice tide, sort of the change for the surroundings, like, they still have those visual cues up. And to me, that was just kind of a sign of, like, there's nothing new that's really populating in this game. And the stuff that I missed, I don't feel like I missed that much. They added time trials, and I thought that was actually fun. I'm like, oh, time trials are great because flying around in this game is probably one of the best things about it. So it kind of follows that they would have something like that, but that's just really underwhelming that after a year of varying content, which has almost always amounted to different buffs and debuffs out in the world, like that's their big varying content in the world, that the most I can really comment on for after a year of Anthem is they added time trials.
Yep.
So
that's about it.
Today is Anthem's birthday.
There also was like, because there is Anthem 2, if they say, or Anthem Now. They've had a whole bunch of nicknames where they're trying to update Anthem to be something. That was confirmed by BioWare. And then they also said, look, because we're busy on this, we're not really going to update the current version of the game. So
right.
See you whenever. And
that's something I do want to repeat, right? Which I think I said something at the end of the episode that we lost to the effect of, God, I hope I'm wrong. Right? Like, I hope that BioWare makes me eat my words and Anthem Next or Anthem 2.0 really is the big change and it really is the comeback story like Battlefront 2 and
Final Fantasy MMO and then...
Crap, why am I spacing on the big...
No Man's Sky. Yeah, there it is.
I would love to, like I said, eat my words and be proved wrong. I cannot express how much I would love for this to turn the other direction, but until that happens... You know, what further statements do I really have of value to make on Anthem, basically?
Nothing, yeah. So that episode. Probably with more, like, frustration because, like you didn't know about the Today is Anthem's birthday tweet, so I think we laughed about that for, like, 20 minutes. But anyway, going back to what we really want to talk to today.
Let's talk about the good parts of BioWare's storytelling ability.
Tevinter Nights. It's now out, and I did what I'd normally do, and I binged the entire thing probably pretty quickly, and then I emailed you saying you have to read these couple stories right now because I need someone to talk to about this. And you did. So today we're really talking about the final story, The Dreadwolf Take You, and then Horror of Hormak. And the rest of them, just a quick thing, like, we'll probably talk about them maybe in a later episode. They're just, like, I hate to say they're less important. They're less lore important, but I think a lot of them are actually really good, and a lot of them I like a lot. There's none of them I actually actively didn't like. There's just some I like less than others. So maybe you only read two stories, so I don't know. You read probably the most important one, and then one that I think is important in like the last couple pages, and then the rest of it's just build up. But so just talking about Horror of Hormak and Dreadwolf Take You, Jordan, what was your experience with these?
Okay, so on the two that I read, I will say that my hunch was pretty much correct. Even before you emailed me about sort of your reaction to it, I had seen the titles that had come out beforehand, and even just browsing the titles and the authors, I'm like, oh, well, that's going to be the big one. It's the one at the end. It's the one by Weeks. Mm-hmm. It's the one that's clearly about Solas. And so when you told me, like, hey, focus in on a couple, I was like, the Dreadwolf Take You, right? Like, that's the big one. And you were like, uh-huh. So I guess just overall, I will start by saying this. The Dreadwolf Take You. Holy fuck.
Right.
fucking hell. Like, I was reading it at work because I just didn't have a lot of time, and I was kind of on my lunch break, and at one point someone walked by me in this little atrium area where I'm sort of like in a chair, and I'm sure my mouth was hanging wide open as I was going, oh! It's like, what the fuck is this guy's problem? He's looking at his phone, and, you know, I've got the digital version, and so, I mean, we'll jump into all the details, but I just want to say, first of all, holy fuck, as a Dragon Age fan, holy fuck, based on, you know, since that teaser trailer came out, and before that, just all of the speculation about the idol and Solas and all of that stuff, holy fuck for everything that you could possibly want as a Dragon Age nerd. But beyond that, that is a goddamn well-written short story.
Right? Okay, so this is not going to make that much sense until we, like, I guess go over the entire script, but, like, I was totally expecting Solas to show up, but not as the bard. I was expecting him to be the executor guy, because I didn't actually think they were going to actually show up. So the fact that Solas dresses up in a wig in a frilly bard costume is absolutely amazing.
That's the one? That's the wig is the thing that got you?
The whole thing, like the costume and then the accent and just the mental image of Solas taking off this, like, the what's going to be the most feared villain, taking off a curly blonde wig just cracked me up.
You know what's really interesting about that? Now that you mention it, in retrospect, that is kind of funny. Yeah. But that was not my takeaway immediately, but you're right. That's actually kind of hilarious.
It's definitely not the immediate takeaway. Just like, it's been I think, like, when did you finish it? Like, yesterday or like the day before or something, maybe?
Yes. Yeah, basically.
Yeah, I binged it. It's been a couple days for me. So I've now processed it a little bit more. And for some reason, that image of him taking off a wig makes me laugh. So, oh boy. So I definitely want to talk about Horror of Hormak, but, like, let's just talk about Dreadwolf Take You first. Where do we just, like, start at the beginning of the story and then just, like, go in chronological order? Because
I'm fine. I mean, yeah, I'm fine with that. I think, yeah, however you want to do it, we can do that.
Okay. So, the story opens, with Charter. If you don't know who Charter is, she's, like, the main spy for Liliana. You can meet her in Inquisition. She's also appeared in Mage Killer that we don't talk much about, she has set up sort of a meeting with various spy organizations from across Thedas. Of course, only three of them show up. A bard, Kafkas is actually Solas, Karta assassin, someone for the Mortalitassi, who's also a part of the Navarran whatever, and an executor. So what the executors are, the scary unknown people from across the sea. There is a war table mission about them, and that's kind of some of the most we have. And they were watching the Inquisition, and they're very unknown and threatening. And so, like, the Karta assassins is like a rough and gruff little dwarf man. The Navarran Mortalitassi woman is like, I don't know, definitely, like, I think, like, I guess she's had, like, stirring her tea with a little spoon, like a magic spoon type of thing, which that comes back later. And then the executor is just this scary robed figure. Like, there's nothing, like, you don't know what race they are, what gender they are. Apparently they're just projecting a voice. Like, you can't tell. And, like, all of it's dialogue is italicized. And then there's the ostentatious bard drinking tea with the dragon mask made of diamonds or something like that, with curly blonde hair and just like really like crazy looking for, but like it's a bard in Orlais. And then as the story goes on, it's essentially like each of the tale, it's the tale that the card assassins have about Solas, and Mortalitassi has about Solas, what the bard says about Solas, which we'll go into, and then the executor has something going on that we'll get to in a moment. So so the overall like arcing narrative there is just, it's a bunch of people talking in a room trying to share information about Solas so they can like get a battle plan. And then we can go on to the individual tales, which I think are probably the bread and butter of the story. So do you want to, we'll start with the assassin, the Carta assassin, because that's the first one you read. And I feel like this is where we also talk about the comics, because this is kind of a story about like where the Red Lyrium idol is, which I thought was going to be the plot of the comics. But this little short story just tells you up front, like what happened, where it has gone, and where it is now. So I don't know what's going to happen in the comics now.
Nothing that matters, essentially, right? Because they just sort of undercut the importance of that plot in a big bad way. It's backstory. If you want to know all the backstory of where the idol's been and the whole history, yeah, that's fine. And I say this as someone who's not read the Mage Killer Blu-ray, that sort of arc yet. But even as someone who hasn't read it, I mean, the criticisms from yourself and others has been that it feels as though they've been trying to piecemeal out like breadcrumbs of information, which has been the total MO of the franchise storytelling post Dragon Age Inquisition, really. Except for this one short story, which just throws a crap ton at us all at once. And it's like, oh, yeah, this is the storytelling of this universe when they're not trying to piecemeal it out. When they just give you a chunk of story and you're like, oh, shit, I'm fully back on board. Not that I was ever off board Dragon Age, but it was just like, oh, yeah, this is why this universe is so exciting. Because when they put the actual main fucking characters that everyone wants to see and get to the heart of the core storyline, it's like, oh, fuck yeah.
I will say, though, like what they were trying to hunt for in the comics was a Red Lyrium imbued sword, which we all thought was Meredith's sword, because that's where the idol was now, even though the sword exploded, but it came back in Inquisition. There's like, oh, like it was kind of clunky, but it made sense in a sense.
Well, now it makes perfect sense.
Well, so but then in this, I think it actually has a better version of what happens to the, like how the isle comes back, which is essentially I've been talking a lot. Do you want to say what the assassin story is, or at least going back and forth here, or do you want me to do it?
No, because I think you'll do a better job on the summary. Okay. One thing I do want to say, though, when we're at that point, like it is a it's a frame story, right? So it's sort of stories within stories. You've got this ensemble of people. They're in this bar or tavern or wherever they are. It's got magic soundproof curtains, which I liked.
Yeah.
I thought that was such that's a weird, cute. Like, of course there's soundproof enchanted curtains, whatever. But I thought that it was fun. Like it really added to the vibe of like the best spies or whoever. Sort of in Thetis coming together for this big meeting. It's a frame story. And so it's a basically third person omniscient viewpoint while we're in the room with them. But as it sort of shifts to each character to tell their story, it goes into a first person. It's just a nice device. Like it's not like it's, frame stories have been around forever, but Weeks really, he really sews a nice yarn with this one. Like you really feel like you're with some of the savviest folks from the different power groups in Thetis trying to hunt down Solas. And so at that point, even before they get into the assassin story, I was just so fucking on board for how he set it up.
I was too. So the Carta assassin, which they don't give names, by the way, so I have to keep saying Carta assassin for the rest of this time. He drinks coffee. Coffee drinker man. He's approached by an elf that's there. I think it's a Dalish elf or city. I can't remember. Anyway, an elf that says like, hey, I dreamt of this potion that if we pour it on the Red Lyrium statue of Meredith, we can get something really cool. And the Carta dwarf's like, well, this seems like there's money in it. So sure. and so they go. And I guess what has happened is that the idol has reformed inside of Meredith using her as a cocoon, and which I think is so much cooler than what I thought would happen with the sword. And they use this potion and like drip it on her, and it like melts away the red lyrium, and like using intense gloves, they like take out the heart, which is, you know, the idol, exactly how we remember it from Dragon Age 2. And they put it in a giant chest because it's singing and doing crazy things, and they bring it back. And then it's kind of like, here's where we get like, this is what Solas is capable of type of stuff. So there's a bunch of card assassins, and the story of the assassin and the Mortalitassi, you'll learn that they're lying, and there's like a whole bunch of like them talking about each other and like blaming each other for all sorts of stuff. But when a bunch of his men are sleeping, they suddenly start having seizures in their sleep. And I think there was even like drool coming out of their mouth, and then they're just dead. Because as we all know, very powerful dreamers can kill people in their sleep. So Solas has just wiped out most of his men as they were sleeping. And then ones that were not sleeping were taken out by elven archers, minus the guy who survived, who's telling the story, saying that he like put some... He took someone's blood, which he killed the elf boy, unfortunately. He put some blood on himself to make him look like he's dead. And he was, like, watching, like, the elves, like, pity the poor guy that had been killed. And, like, looking for the Lyrium idol, but they'd already sold it to someone in Tevinter and, like, doing all that sorts of stuff. But just, like, I mean, for one, I think this proves that Felisson is dead. I'm sorry, everybody. We all wanted him to survive. Dory, are you... You didn't actually read that novel, did you, Masked Empire?
Nope, sure didn't.
Yeah, one of the best characters in Masked Empire is a character named Felisson. And at the very, like, his I'm going to spoil the book for you, I'm sorry. At the very end, you find out that he was working for Solas, and his shtick was to take the Illuvians away from Briala. And then he starts to really care for Briala, and decides not to. And then he goes to face Solas, trying to say, like, look, maybe we should let these elves give a chance. And Solas, well, the book just really ends. And so we're like, oh, he probably killed him. What if he made him tranquil? Because he killed him in the Fade. But I think this just proves that, like, no, he can kill people from the Fade, you know? he's gone. R.I.P. Never forget. But it's, there's just some, like... It's one of those things, like, we knew he was able to do that, but now, like, to see it happen and to, like, actually, like, I say see, but, like, you know, read it being happening and, like, the consequences of it and, like, how awful it sounds to suddenly just be having, like, a seizure and, like, your ears start bleeding, you know, which it sounds like your brain is melting almost, you know?
Yeah. It was wicked. It was like, holy fuck. There's a lot of what Solas is capable of, and there's, we'll get to more of that in some of the other stories as well, but there's a lot of what Solas is capable of. which was somewhat awesome, and also it kind of made me laugh at one part, but anyway, continue.
So that's the assassin story, and then we go on to the Mortalitassi story.
The Mortalitassi drinks mulled wine.
How do you remember that?
It's very important. I thought that was so fucking cool. Like, we'll get to why it's important. You could say it's cheesy, you could say it's almost like a little tacky. I thought it was cool as fuck, because as I was reading it, I fucking picked up on it. I'm like, why? Like, okay, maybe that's just to add to their personality, like different personalities have different drinks, but they really mentioned it. Like, I feel like Weeks like mentioned it a couple of times, and like, what's up with these fucking different drinks thing?
I was reading so fast, I think I might have missed this, so I really have to read it again. Dyslexia and pregnancy brain is not doing me any favors with this novel, let me tell you. It's not doing very good. There was one part in the novel that you'll get to later where like I read something and it didn't make any sense. I just thought it was badly written. And I was talking to Jack about it. And he's like, what? No, it's not this. It's this. I'm like, what? And like, I feel like I'm going crazy. And I go back and read it. And like, I had just read it wrong and remembered it wrong. And it's baby's taking all my brain cells, Jordan. I don't know what to do anymore. Anyway, so Mortalitassi story. Mortalitassi story is probably my favorite one just because of the like, holy shit factor. Trying to really prune it down to the bread and butter, she gets herself into, I say gets herself, like she wasn't complicit, but the Tevinter mage that originally bought it, who I think, I can't remember who it is, but I thought it was someone of the Daenerys house who was the one who bought Fenris.
Yes.
Yeah, okay, so he, you know, which I think he's dead now, so rip.
Never forget.
Yeah, unless Solas is the thing. Anyway. So they essentially take the idol, and it kind of sounds like they're trying to break into the Black City. So it's the second sin Sin 2 Boogaloo or whatever you want to call it.
Second Sin 2 Boogaloo.
Well, the second sin in Thetis is when the Magister's broken.
Yeah, yeah. No, no, I follow. That's good.
It's that again. And they use the idol, which then, like, okay, so think of the idol. I'm like, I don't know why I'm pretending to hold it and you can't see me and this is an audio format. But you have the idol and, like, there's, like, the red lyrium shards at the bottom. It turns into, like, a knife or something. And he uses that to, I think, stab the slaves that he has brought. And essentially use a blood magic ritual with the idol to open up a hole into the Fade to walk into the Black City. And as it opens, they are met with probably the most, as I hit my mic, the most chilling thing we have seen so far. A giant wolf with 6 eyes and wings of fire that turn into demons that attack everybody, saying, "You use my idol," we'll get to that in a minute, "to do these things. This is, you will not do this. You will not destroy the world." And the giant wolf then chomps the leader and, like, brings him back into the Fade as the demons kill everybody else.
Holy fuck, right? Like, first of all, like, that was badass as shit, but there was a part of me when this happened where I'm like, holy shit, it's fucking Salos.
It's no, Salos was still a person, wolf. Though.
Well, he was riding on a giant wolf. You know what I mean. It was close enough where I'm like, okay, come on.
Well, okay, the giant wolf thing was set up in the game, though, so I like the giant wolf. Giant 8-foot-tall Salos is a whole other story.
Well, also, like, just vindictive, angry, sort of like you're it honestly had kind of a Corypheus vibe of, like, you meddle with forces beyond your ken kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm. Like you poor stupid children, you're about to destroy the world and you have no idea what you're doing. Let me chomp off your head and just get out. I'm not even going to bother with you. Get out of here.
Yeah, it was definitely full Solas, full, you know, Fen Haral, fuck you. You are not going to fuck around with shit that you shouldn't be.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It was epic. It was badass.
Yeah. But he doesn't take the idol back, which I thought was strange. The idol gets swiped up by another mage and then taken to another place. Which, maybe. That's another thing. No, it does, because the Immortalitas says it happened in the bard. Because the bard story is technically Solas' story, and that's one of those things where, like, I don't know what's the truth anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But all of his dialogue in that sense of that story is, like, in all caps because it's big and booming, and it's just absolutely nuts. And this is, like, the first time you really get to see, like people weren't even sure if he was able to turn into the big bad wolf thing. Like,
right.
We just thought, like, maybe that could be something else. So now it is confirmed. Yeah, no, that's a thing we'll have to deal with, probably.
Right. It's a visual spectacle that we now have to look forward to, because we're going to see that. To me, it's like, we are going to see that happen in Dragon Age 4. And it's, you know, there's been so much around Solas that is just speculation and what if and building to and potential. And now it's like, oh, shit. Fuck yeah, the Dread Wolf. Like, this is what it is.
Mm-hmm. And then I think something that, like, was... I don't have words. But, like, it's his idol.
It's
his idol. Do you know how long we've been wondering what the hell that is?
Right.
It's his. Why is it his? What is it? Which will, there's another part of that. But before we go into that, let's go into the Bard's Tale. Now, the Bard's Tale we do find is Solas. So this is one of the things where, like, I feel like there's a couple different options. Like, there was a bard that did something like this, and then Solas had to tweak the end of the story because he killed the bard and then took his identity. Mm. Or if this is just, like... Or if this actually happened and he just made up the point of view from the bard.
Yes.
Or the whole thing is false and he just wants to let everyone know that he now has the idol. Because the story that he tells is that he was invited to an auction... Because the mage that took the idol sold it for auction, apparently. I don't know.
Yeah.
And the auction is in the Black Emporium. One thing I thought was really interesting. So the bard describes other people who were in the Emporium. And it's pretty much all people we have seen in the series so far. You had someone that sounded like Talis, I think Sebastian, an Avar chieftain that was in Inquisition. Divine Victoria, a warden commander, which probably means the warden. So everyone that we know in the series, pretty much kind of like in places that didn't really appear in Inquisition that much that Solas wouldn't have known, I think he's letting us know that he knows who they are.
Right. Oh, he's aware of all the players.
Yeah, we know. He knows. Which I thought was kind of like, oh, that's a nice little subtle, like, ooh. Okay.
Yeah.
Then while the auction's going on, the bard sneaks down to like this giant area of like where all like the other stuff is kept in the Black Emporium, and finds that the Canary and the Deventers, right? They were both trying to find this idol, and they bust down a wall and they find a shrine with an alluvian in the middle, and I believe it was a wolf and a Hala for Fenharel and Gilinan. Is that correct?
I can't remember.
And they start fighting for it, and then Solas in the Bard's Tale, Solas comes from the alluvian, and everyone starts running away, and then he turns them into stone. He picks up the idol, caresses the middle figure, like the mother figure of it, and then leaves. And that's the end of the Bard's Tale. And then everyone starts calling out each other's tale, like, well, that doesn't make sense, and then that doesn't make sense, and then this doesn't make sense. And at this point, Charter's just like, spare me. Please don't kill me. And they're like, we're not going to kill you. And she's like, I'm not talking to
you. I'm not asking you. Oh, it's so fucking great.
And then she turns to the bard, and the bard's just kind of playing it cool. He's like, how do you know?
The bard drinks tea, or rather doesn't.
Yeah, he ordered tea and didn't drink it. And there's a whole bunch of other little tales that I thought were really clever. And then the final one is, at one point, the executor and the assassin were arguing. And to stop the argument, the bard gets in between. It puts a hand up to the assassin and then lightly touches the executor. And then for the rest of the novel, the executor doesn't talk again. So he had petrified him underneath his clothes and no one else could tell. So the executor's dead.
Yeah.
But Charter had noticed. Solas essentially says, all right, you asked for your life, I will grant it to you. And he kills the other two with petrification. And then in a moment that I thought was like this... a really good little Solas moment to be like, this is still the guy we knew from Inquisition. He takes out that enchanted stirring spoon that the Mortalitassi had, frees the spirit from it, and says, like, you're free now, little one, and, like, it goes off. And then just turns to Charter, and they have, like, a nice little conversation about, like, she's like, why did you come here? He's like, well, I just want to know what you knew. And also, like, I just tell the Inquisitor I'm sorry, okay? And she's like, yeah, okay.
Well, yeah, wait, you're right. It's a fucking phenomenal moment. But also, like, doesn't he say, like, I'm not a god?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, because like she was obviously afraid. And he goes, look, I'm not a god. I'm a fool. I'm hot-headed. There's another one he said, like, I'm just trying to do his best for my people. Okay.
It was a phenomenal moment. Like, I understand from a certain standpoint, you could say like, oh, the lore or whatever. I think, you know, you and many other people had already said like, well, they're really elven god was always, we kind of knew that was really just hyper powerful mages. It was more just the quote unquote human moment for Solas to just be like, I'm not even what people say I am. I'm just trying to do this thing that he believes is necessary or right. Mm-hmm. And he knows that it comes with collateral. It just humanized him a lot in that moment.
And then he even tells her, because Charter's an elf, he's like, you know, maybe you would even find the end result something agreeable.
But people I care for would not. Yeah.
Yeah. She says, yeah, because she's in love with Tessa, a human. She's like, well, the people I would, you know, what you just said, the quote, he's like, not really. He's like, well, I get that too. I completely understand. Like, it's all right. And then he just leaves, you know?
Holy fuck. I was just literally reading it going, holy fuck, like Dragon Age 4, please. But even not even just Dragon Age 4, please. Like, this was so great to me because it felt like finally it was a moment where, yeah, honestly, I don't have to say Dragon Age 4, please. Like, this was it. Like, this by itself. This fucking story was a lot. I mean, obviously, I still want a lot more. Mm-hmm. But this was maybe the first time since Inquisition where the main storyline of Dragon Age was being addressed upfront and directly, and we got meaningful movement on the plot and the characters. And I was so fucking satisfied with it. I dug it immensely.
And I think what a good there's a lot of questions that the fandom had in between Inquisition and what's going to be Dragon Age 4. And a lot of, like, little things that we had that we didn't quite, for us kind of clunked or didn't make sense, were actually filled in with either this story or other parts of the novel, which I thought were great. Like, we wondered, like, why does Solas have, because in the end of the Trespasser slides, we saw Dalish elves leaving and, like, other elves leaving. Like, if Solas said he was going to destroy the world, is he lying to these people? We didn't quite know what his plan was. And at the very end of the line, when he's talking to Charter, we know that, well, the elves will find it agreeable, but maybe that's about it. So suddenly it makes sense why all those people are joining him.
Mm-hmm.
So it's in, like, there's another story later on where you learn that, like, he's actually recruiting, like, real, you know, modern elves, which is something we were kind of debating. Like, is there just, like, his people old ancient elves? And then, one part in the assassin's story, you find out that his party is a mix of ancient elves and modern elves. And
he's taking recruits.
Yeah, he's taking recruits, but he's also using ancient ones as well. We like for the idol, like where is the idol? Now we know where the idol is, even though I thought that's where the comic was, but we'll get to that later. like it's now his idol, and there's something like the main woman figure in the quick rundown of the idol layout. It's a woman that looks very sad and motherly, and she's cradling one in the front and one in the back of two male figures, and he cradles the one the mother figure. So we're wondering, like, why did he do that? Like, and it's also Solas telling that part of the story. Why did he find it necessary to tell everyone that he would caress that figure, whether he did it or not? Which is kind of like a more like what? What is this for? What he has previously said that people shouldn't mess with the blight because it's just stupid to do so. But he has a red lyrium idol, which is a blight lyrium. Right. So is he saying like was that previous line like, look, I tried, it did not work. Let me tell you. Is that what that was? Like, there's just so many more questions, and it's but in like a good way, I almost want to say. So yeah, like now, okay. So what was the thing about the drink? Because that missed me completely.
Oh, just like what do you mean? Like how they used it?
Yeah.
Well, just like the fact that he was like, I didn't like tea, and that was the giveaway. Like I thought that was very interesting that it was set up so, because they could have easily just done it with Solas, right? But they Patrick Weeks. Set that up for each of them, right? Like the executor drank dark red wine. Like they each had their own drink, except the bards didn't make sense when they weren't drinking it. And that was one of the tells that it was soulless.
That's true, because the other two get refills on theirs. And then,
yes.
And he does.
Yeah, like they keep it up with the coffee, the mulled wine, the dark. And I'm like, why is he going into so much detail with what kind of drinks they want? It would be enough to mention it at the beginning as a little personality color.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that they keep up the descriptions of the drinks, I'm like, that'll be used more. Which I really, really dug. I just think the entire framing, the structure of the story, the devices that were used, it was very, very well done. It is, yeah, I mean, I don't need to say this. It's not like people don't know. Patrick Weeks can write his motherfucking ass off. Like, this guy is really fucking good at writing stories.
And I'm very excited to see what happens with the next game.
Well, the next game, but even just like in the format of prose, do you know what I mean? Like, it's one thing to write a story for a video game. And I'll talk about this a little bit with the horror of Hormak, but it's sometimes I think the best thing you can do is to let your writing get out of the way of the story.
Mm-hmm.
And Weeks does that very, very well in The Dreadwolf Take You. It is the classic definition of a page turner, where if you're sitting down to read it, you're going, holy shit, like I've been here for longer than I thought and time flew by, and never once does the writing distract you from the story.
Yeah.
Which is really, really important.
There were definitely other stories in this collection, which, again, I did like them all, like, you know, whatever. But this one is the longest story by far. And there were others that I felt were longer.
Is it?
They weren't.
Yeah, that's so weird, right? Because it felt like I was like, it's over? That's it?
Yeah. But no, it's one of the longest. I will say, I think maybe Eight Little Talons either close or maybe a little bit. But I'm pretty sure this one's the longest. But yeah, it's you want to read the entire thing and like you want to read it again. Like, did I really just read that?
Yeah, it's a clever tale.
What is it?
One thing that I did sort of notice almost immediately, like as soon as Solas got revealed. Mm-hmm. And again, I know that this is not like super unique because frame stories have been around for a long time. But in particular, a frame story where the subject of all of the stories ends up being disguised in the room.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with an episode of Batman the Animated Series called Almost Got Him?
No, I am not.
It is one of the most famous episodes of Batman the Animated Series, so this goes back to probably like, I don't know, the early 90s. And I just wonder if Patrick Weeks is a fan of this story, of this episode, because it's the exact same fucking setup. And again, there's no... You know, lots of people have used these devices, but it's exactly that. It's a bunch of, it's the Joker and the Penguin, Two-Face, Poison Ivy. They're all sitting around. They've got this poker game going on. And there's no Batman. And that's pretty unusual for a formulaic kids show, right? Like, for the most part, it's all just them telling stories about how they almost beat Batman.
Mm-hmm.
And they each sort of tell their own individual stories. And then in the end, is it, oh, crap, who is he? maybe it's Two-Face. I think it's maybe he's disguised as Two-Face. Batman's actually there.
Nah.
And so he's actually, he knew that they were getting together and they were all supposed to plan how to team up and get him this time. And so they all go, well, I almost got him this time and I almost got him this time. So Batman had gotten wind of this and he had showed up to this poker game disguised as, maybe it was Killer Croc, maybe it was Two-Face. I can't quite remember, but he's disguised as one of them with a mask and he changed his voice and whatever. And he's like, I'm here, bitches. And then he, you know, biff, boom, pows all of them. And so as soon as it got to Solas revealing himself, I'm like, holy shit, Patrick Weeks must really like Batman the Animated Series.
I mean, it's a good series.
And again, I'm actually sure that there's actually better literary examples of that device being used, but that's just what I thought of when I got to that part.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Was there anything else you want to touch on for this story before we go on to Hormak?
I don't have the words to communicate how smoothly written it is. There's no wasted motion in any of his prose, right? Mm-hmm. Everything from the word choices to the sentence structures to what he calls attention to in the room and with the characters. That's a really hard thing to do. It just evidences the fact that Patrick Weeks is a goddamn master of his craft.
Mm-hmm.
And it's helpful that he has a damn good story, like the core of the story. But it's like a home run. It's a 7 out of 7 if I was going to give it a rating on our famous
on
BioWare
scale
score.
Of interest.
Yes, I would give it a 7 out of 7 because I think it's just he nailed it. He had a really good story, a point A, point B, point C, and he got through it all without any distractions on the storytelling. So I thought it was excellent.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, let's go on to Hormak. I'll let you tell the story of Hormak because for me, I'm really only focusing in on like the last couple pages. Again, that's really important to me. And like, I thought it was a fine story overall. But like the last couple pages is the one that's like, ooh, this is really important lore wise. So to tell me, Jordan, if you want to even go through it all, what happens in the horror of Hormak?
Well, this should be fun to see how much I actually remember of it because I was reading some of it half asleep. Well, how would I summarize it? I think you're so much better at summarizing stories than I am, but I'll just say, so it follows Ramesh, right? He's the warden who is looking for Jovis, who's one of his warden companions. He is with a mage whose name I'm already forgetting. Ladesh or something like that? Yes, Lesha. Her name is Lesha. So those are your two main characters, and they're trying to find these wardens who are Warden Jovis, right? And it's... I don't know. I guess to me, what I would say is it's like a dungeon crawler story. It's a horror story. It's got a lot of grotesque, ugly shit. They're going down sort of past the deep roads in search of this warden party. I mean, I guess before that, they find, God, I don't remember the other character's name, but they find someone who's from this party who has seen some horrible shit.
Yeah. Like she's gouged out her eyes.
So let's not bury the lead there. She has gone so crazy that she is just, she's completely lost it. She's gouged out her eyes. They tie her up, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, we think we need to tie her up for her own safety. They don't want to leave her, but they know that they need to continue onward to get to the rest of the people to help them.
Mm-hmm.
So they tie her up, and then in the middle of the night, Ramesh hears screaming or something, right? And then they find out that she has chewed through, she didn't just chew through the restraints, she gnawed her own hands off, her own wrists off or something to get free, and now she's just going crazy. And at one point she starts retching up like this sort of gray fluid that has like a brine odor to it, sort of like smells like the ocean kind of a thing, and she's just gushing out more of this gray fluid that could possibly be humanly possible. I don't know. I guess that might be a good pause point, because at that point, I was very interested in the story. Like, I will say, like, I was like, okay, this is horrific. It's awful. It's clearly playing on horror tropes, and I'm into it. I was curious to see what was going to happen next by that point.
I mean, me too. I feel like all of the stuff I really want to say is at the end, so I feel like I'm not going to add much. But yeah, no, I think it was an elven mage. It was another female person.
Yes.
I don't remember. But yeah.
But, so eventually they find, well, that character, dies.
Yeah, she's dead.
She's dead. She's totally dead because you can't gush up all that.
all that and then gnaw your own arms off.
Yes.
Or whatever.
And Ramesh kills her. I'm like, yeah, he actually has to, at some point he's deciding he has to kill her. Because she's
put her out of her misery.
Yes. Yeah. So they find a passageway that's sort of, it's this huge, like, sort of spiral staircase going down deep underground into this cave. They find traces of the party that they're looking for, so it's clear that they've gone down this way. And then they find themselves down in the deep roads.
Mm-hmm.
I will say, like, again, like you, I think most of this story's punch is kind of towards the end, or the end-ish.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll kind of jump through. I'm probably skipping over some parts, but I will tell you that the sequence from here of what I thought was important was this. Everything is elves. That was the first thing that I noticed, because long story short, they keep pushing downward, you know, into the deep roads. And at some point, and even though I was half asleep as I was reading this part, I was like, really? Because at some point, Ramesh is getting down deep and he realizes that the architecture and sort of the trappings of where they're at is no longer dwarven. It's becoming clearly elven.
Mm-hmm.
And the line was that from time to time that wardens have noticed that somewhere in the deep roads, even though there's it's not all dwarven architecture, that clearly some of it is elven ruins.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have to pause there because I might be a little bit out of my depth on the lore. Has that ever been stated before?
Well, it was shown in Trespasser. Because you go into a underground Lyria mine that is definitely elven. And
oh, that's true.
Yeah. I will say that some of the other things that are brought up later are actually brought up in the series, but they weren't specifically said they were elven. They were just some unknown thing.
Yeah.
Like the big statue, which will, not the statue, but the mural relief thing.
Yes.
That was actually, I think, mentioned in actually Dragon Age Origins, something like that, which we can talk about that. So it's sort of set up. It's definitely newer, but it is sort of set up.
Yeah. So that was just one thing where I was like, so many people have always complained that everything in Dragon Age is about the elves.
Yeah.
And very commonly, what about the dwarves? And I'm just like, oof, what a gut punch. Even the fucking deep roads are elven. Like the one thing that's decidedly dwarven. It's like, nah, actually it was elven first.
Well, okay, go on.
But anyway, they keep going down deeper, and eventually, again, I'm probably skipping through a lot of it here, but eventually they come to, like, let's just not bury the lead here. It's a fucking monster factory of fucked up darkspawn mixed with other things, and, like, the head of a darkspawn with the body of a drake, and it's...
Yeah, like, darkspawn with, like, scorpion tails and snakes for arms and just some nutty things. Like, absolutely nuts.
That is essentially what this other mage character had seen. It drove her insane. She probably saw all of her friends and everybody get turned. Well, we're getting to that where it's like horrible monsters, and they're getting attacked, right? And they're in this giant chamber, which maybe you should explain this part because it is a sort of relief sculpture that has
That's before that. Well, I guess it's technically not. Okay, we'll go on.
It's sort of at the same time, right? Like, when they get into this mm-hmm. chamber, they find this sculpture, which has a lot of intricate sort of things carved into it that clearly mm-hmm. seem to be of significance for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
Even
so, go on.
I was going to say, like, even as I was reading that part of it, and it's you know, John Epler is the person who writes this story, and there's great detail about what's carved in there. And I'm like, I'm sure if I opened up the wiki, I could be able to, like, backtrace the significance of all of this. I go, but I'm just going to let Katie worry about that.
Probably for the best.
And I was just like, I was interested in the fact that it was a monster factory. That was the part of the story that I'm like, I just want to see more fucked up monsters pop out.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, what should we describe a little bit of what was carved into this sculpture? Or should we wait to the end? Because it's really about what it points to, right?
Yeah, it's really more about what it's pointing to rather than what it's showing.
Okay, so maybe we should wait until the very end.
Okay, we'll wait to the end. You guys have to wait. Okay.
So in any event, long story short, they're fighting off these fucking crazy ass like monsters that are combinations of a bunch of other monsters, and they come across a particularly grotesque one that happens to be sort of melded with Warden Jovis, who is mm-hmm. the person that Ramesh is looking for. They pretty heavily hint at, if not outright describe, that there's a romance between Jovis and Ramesh.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is someone that he cares about very much, and they've been sort of melded with a goddamn awful, terrible monster.
Mm-hmm.
Who they then have to fight. And crap, I forgot his companion's name again. Lesha.
Lesha, yeah.
Lesha helps him survive, ends up sacrificing herself to protect Ramesh, and he ends up sort of escaping by the skin of his teeth with some lyrium explosions, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Overall, pretty interesting story. Some pretty fucked up shit happened. But when it comes to that sculpture that we referenced earlier, that had some intricate things pointing to essentially other locations like this, essentially, right? Like there's at the very least more of this shit out there somewhere else in a bunch of other places.
So I got the description of the carving up. So first, sorry, I was also trying to find this. You mentioned that they blew it up, right?
Yes, with the lyrium, yeah. Giant lyrium crystal. Yeah.
So apparently this location is gone. So Hormak, whatever the horror of Hormak is, apparently it's in ruins. So first, let's backtrack to when they're going down and they're noticing like cave paintings almost of it's always three figures, and the two of them figures changes depending on, I guess, who's drawing it, because it's looked like drawn by some multiple people, except the middle figure is always the same. So there is some sort of monster, some sort of worshiper, and in the middle is a woman, a priestess is what they call her in the thing, and it just keeps repeating. And the priestess is always the same, but the monster and the person are different. And it's like, what's going on there? And that is leading up into a hallway where it eventually gets up to this giant relief carving. Not reading it exactly, but just what it basically is, like, there's a topmost brand that has like elven kings and queens and their court and people kneeling and then like, you know, giving respect. And then in the middle, there's like scenes of like healing, disease and whatnot. And, you know, healing the sick and dying, as they say.
Mm-hmm.
And on the bottom, there's Aravels being driven by Hala that look a bit strange to certain mountains. Later on, as they go back, they like revisit to that view, and they see something a lot more. It's not that the relief changed, it's just their reading of it changed. It seemed a lot more evil. Like, instead of worshipping kings and queens, they were, like, forced to do so. There were slaves going on these Aravels. They're not healing the sick and dying, they're creating the sick and dying. And it's just, like, this really scary thing. So first, I want to pause here and talk about this giant relief. So, this is not the first time we've heard of a such relief. Now, I will say that the description of it that was given, and I think Dragon Age Origins, it's either Dragon Age Origins 2, I can't remember right now, I probably should look it up eventually. We actually hear from Bodan. It's a little bit different, but Sandal was actually found near something very similar.
Oh.
Yeah. And they were here, as the story goes, if I remember correctly, sorry, I have to... Fun facts: when you're pregnant, all of your organs get squished and your air capacity gets lower, so I feel myself when I'm talking, what I can normally handle now is completely shortened, and I just run out of breath a lot faster.
Don't get lightheaded. Remember to breathe, Katie.
I'm trying, but like I feel like I go to a rant, and then I realize like I can't breathe anymore. I have to go, okay, so that's going to happen a couple times. But anyway, as the story goes from Bodan, they were in the deep roads trying to find something, and they hear weird noises, and there's darkspawn everywhere, and then they find a small little boy by this giant relief of things. I think he mentioned it was paragons or something, but I can't remember what exactly he says. I do remember him saying it was very strange and odd, but it was also covered in jewels, which is what this one is described to be looking like.
Mm-hmm.
And then Sam's just like, hey, what's up? Like, you know, Sam doesn't talk, but he was very nice and kind. And they wanted to get Sandal away from the scary noises that were coming, so they picked up the small little boy and ran. So now I'm wondering, hey, what's Sandal, huh? Was he living in near one of these?
Yeah.
Because apparently there's 11 more of them. So what was that all about? There has never been any answers on Sandal. There's just been more mystery. And I feel like this just added more to the mystery of Sandal.
Yeah, no, that's completely true. And I didn't even realize that it was connected to Sandal, but you're 100% right.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that's just another, like, what is Sandal? Is he actually important? And is he actually connected to elves? Or were some people wondering if he was the child of King Adukin and his elven mistress? Is that something related there? Mm-hmm. Or maybe not? Who knows? So that's the thing. So then we're going in to the actual, actually, Well, no, we'll talk about it now, because even though he says it later in the novel, it's still about the relief. So he talks about these scenes repeating 12 different times. So there's one for Hormak, because he was able to recognize the mountains in that area being the mountains in the relief, and there's mm-hmm. other mountains in the whatever. So first, I want to talk about actually what Hormak is. So Hormak is one of the great Dwarven kingdoms, and it was one of the last four to actually survive. Eventually, it was cut down by the Darkspawn. The others that we have by name, I think we only have four by name, which is Hormak, Gundar, Khal Sharak, and Orzammar. Here's the thing. There was 12 of them.
Oh, right. So has he...
So are there one of these things under Orzammar?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that would be fucking badass, to be quite honest. But yeah, that would make perfect sense.
Uh-huh. So, and then there's also one of Khal Sharak. Now, let's talk about Khal Sharak real quick, because Khal Sharak has survived all these years, and we don't know how. But we do know there were the way that the people from Khal Sharak are talked about are a little bit off. They're a little bit different. There's something tainted about it. We're not quite sure what it is. Did somehow they, to try to defeat the Darkspawn, broke into whatever this is and did something with it? Do all of them turn them into monsters, or they do something a little bit different? We're not quite sure.
That's what I was going to say. Is like, are they all houses of horror monster factories, or are they like vaults in Fallout where they all kind of have a different theme and do something else?
Yeah. This one was very obviously, because they're talking about like Hala different things. Like this one is definitely connected to Gilanon, who is the elven god of the Hala, whatever. But she's also known to make monsters. That's her shtick, is monster making. So if this was only supposed to be for Gilanon, the monster-making thing makes sense. But if there were 12 others, like, granted, there's not 12 gods, but maybe there was some other, like, maybe some people had two, we don't know. Did they all do something different? Which is just her laboratory, and there's laboratories underneath the ground. Could we have even found another quote-unquote laboratory, and that was the Lyria Mining Factory, because we saw in Trespasser? I'd be better than that. So, that's more of that. And then let's actually get to the goo part. Now, something that was really interesting to me was that the lyrium chandelier, so there's like a lyrium chandelier above all this gray brine goo. It was described as being lyrium with a yellow-green flex to it. So the way it described, I don't know if it's supposed to be a new type of lyrium that's yellow-green or some type of like regular blue lyrium that's been sort of slightly twisted in a way that now has this yellow-green shimmers in it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I think, like, either way is important, because something is definitely different about this lyrium, and it definitely shouldn't be what it is. So there's that whole aspect. And then let's get to the goo. So the Darkspawn, when they just touch it, they get, like, trapped in this cocoon and turn into these weird monsters. And I forgot who said that. I think, what was his name? Jessavish? That's not it. That's something else. Jovis?
Jovis, yeah. Jovis.
Jovis, okay. So when Jovis... when he's able to, you know, become Jovis again and, like, kind of say the final goodbyes, he talks about that the Wardens are different than the Darkspawn because they have to drink it. Just story-wise, why did they drink it, Jordan?
Yeah.
Can we just, like, so I don't, maybe they were forced by something. If they were forced by something, we don't know what that is, and they never said it. But if they weren't forced by anything, why would you go into the Deep Roads, see Darkspawn getting cocooned in this thing, and be like, looks delicious?
Because Grey Wardens just think they can fix everything by drinking it.
I don't know. Like, there was that priestess image, and, like, there was talking about, like, who is she? And the guy's like, you know, that's the wrong question, and then goes to attack him. So I almost want to say, like, maybe there is some presence there that they didn't see. But if, because that's the only way this makes sense to my mind. But if that's not the case, then, like, that's definitely a question that I would really like to see. Like, if someone asked Epler, please don't do it on our behalf, because I would be embarrassed. But
but he also says she can't be allowed to have it, right? Is he just talking about the location itself, or?
I think. But I don't know what it is. It's definitely, like, there's a lot of vagueness. Yeah. Where I'm not quite sure what happened.
Which is very interesting, right? Because when Jovis says she can't be allowed to have it, and you're right, Ramesh says, who can't be allowed? And he says, you're asking the wrong question. I thought he was going to say the question is what, and not who, but it doesn't exactly go into detail on that either.
Yeah, or even, like, what the right question is.
Right.
So, you're like, so yeah.
But
and there's yeah, go
I was just gonna say, but it does seem like based on like the wall paintings of what was it, a person and a monster, the priestess is always the same, but the creatures are different. To me, it's like, well, then maybe all of the do each of the 12 locations have a different priestess character, or is it one central person responsible for all of these locations?
Mm-hmm. Like, is this Gilinan herself, or did she create like 12 little things, and these are like different priests and priestesses of Gilinan that have done this, and like they have somehow survived up until now because Gilinan's supposed to be locked away and wherever,
right?
So there's a lot of questions. Now, I will say to quickly talk about Gilinan. There's been, like, in Trespasser, there's a codex called Notes on Methods of Enchantment. Do you remember that one?
No.
It's for the skin that stalks armor, and you get it as you get the, it's, like, updated as you do it. Essentially, someone, didn't say who, talking about, like, they're trying to do, like, this enchantment on, like, this really fancy thing, and it's not quite working. And at the very end, they're like, oh, I got it working. And you also find out, like, they're trying to, I'm going to say leather, because it's a leather-based, suit that you would later craft, but you find out that she because of probably Gilinan using leather from someone who's alive still, and at one point they're like, she's like, okay, well, I had to use all of it, so I explained to the creature, like, I'm sorry, like, I'm using all of it because I want to do all this cool, so you're it's going to die, and you're like, oh, that's scary. Okay, cool. So there's definitely some like evilness, if you will, to Gilinan that has been hinted throughout the series. To speak on the brine part, why it smells like the ocean, there is another elven story where she, to become a god, so she created all these different monsters and horrific things, and then to become a god, the other gods are like, look, can you just, like, not, just kill all these things and we'll make you a god? And she's like, cool, I'll do it. So she kills everything except for Hala, and because, as I quote, pride with a capital P stopped her hand, sea monsters.
Oh, yeah.
So is that somehow related to this brine stuff? Did somehow soul it, like, sea monster? I don't know how to quite connect it in my brain, but I feel like there's something there with, like, sea monsters and why this smells like the ocean. I have no idea what it is, though.
Yeah, because it's mentioned. I mean, no, but it's clearly, yeah, it's mentioned every time. It's like the strong smell of the ocean.
Mm-hmm. Like, it is very much brine and ocean. And, like, other than that, Gilinan doesn't really have a connection to the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know why that would be important other than that story, and I'm not quite getting the connecting pieces to it. Now, one thing I want to bring up, because it just came to me, the warden who apparently did drink because she was vomiting the stuff violently, was she an elf? She was an elf, wasn't she?
I don't remember.
I'm pretty sure she was an elf. Okay, I have to look this up now, because if she was an elf and drank and then didn't turn into a monster, then I have questions, because at least one of the humans did. So let me zoom through this story.
I feel like it okay. would have said it right when she was first seen.
Yeah, and they don't say it, do they? Okay, so I thought she was an elf. Maybe she is. I, like, as a quick rush through, I can't find it again. And, like, I've only read this once, and I can't have a terrible memory. So if I guess my main question is, why didn't she turn into some weird item, some weird monster? Or did she just not get there yet?
Right, perhaps she was about to. She was in the process of it. Or maybe she had to have been down there for some reason.
Yeah, I don't know. And there's a lot of questions on how she was able to, like, was there something about gouging out her eyes that helped her not turn into something?
That's another thing, or, yeah.
And so then why are the eyes important? There was a, in one of, I want to say it's a mystery, but I think it's just a fan service thing, a little cutesy thing. In the world of Thetis, there is this, it's sort of, there's like a bunch of pages that are kind of randomly thrown in, and I forgot what the real world equivalent is, but it's essentially a bunch of pictures with a text that no one can read. And one of the things that they were able to translate in the real world, or in the, I don't know how to describe this very well, but someone that they was able to decipher a few of the things that were talked about in this weird book with pictures and letters that they can't read. And one of them was that somehow the eyes are, like, it talks about the eyes being, like, the window to, like, possession and stuff like that, which is kind of strange. So I'm wondering if, like, is that somehow related to this? And so, like, maybe she knew that or got some, there something about the eyes being very important, and so she just plopped them out, or, I don't know.
Yeah.
There's a lot of mystery here. And I feel like the reason I wanted you to read this one specifically was just because it creates all of these new mysteries that uses some parts that we've already had
mm-hmm.
and that we didn't know were necessarily connected and how they're connected. And I hope this comes back in some regard because it having these 11 monster factories, let's say, just waiting around, perhaps even one under one, like the Dwarven epicenter
right.
of Orzammar, is a huge thing. And we need to do something about it. And now Ramesh actually survives, so he can go out and tell the Wardens. So the
right.
Wardens will know this. So is this what the Wardens are going to be doing in Dragon Age 4? I don't know.
That was exactly my interest in it. And I was right about to say, for this story, I get that there's a lot of intrigue and a lot of it could mean this and it could mean this and it could link back to this. I'm all for that for the sake of the fandom, but we've been getting a lot of stuff that's like that for a while
yeah.
now. And so when you compare and contrast to the Dreadwolf Take You, it's like, this is, Dreadwolf Take You is a payoff. To me, it's not even teasing for Dragon Age 4, in and of itself, it is somewhat of a payoff to sort of build that connective tissue, but still be a really entertaining and strong short story on its own. Horror of Hormak is, it's a good story. There's something to the story. It's got a beginning, middle, and end. It's got some character stuff in there, but it is a lot more about building lore intrigue rather than standing on its own. And there's actually nothing wrong with that, except at this point, I feel like there's a lot of that with Dragon Age.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of just, it would, to me, it's better if we could get to more stories that are really contained within themselves.
Mm-hmm. I think there are a couple of those that are like that in because you've already read two and I've read all of them.
Yeah.
There are a couple like that, but there's also a lot of other ones, or the more Horror of Hormak, and I think they kind of be in the middle. There's some an old Crow's Old Tricks, which I think is a fun little story. I don't think it's going to have any impact. I just think it's a fun story.
Mm-hmm,
I don't think any of those people are showing up. And there's a couple of that. And there's others that I think the actual story is not going to matter so much Dragon Age 4, but it's going to be some sort of it was setting up a concept that we'll need later on.
Yeah.
There's something called the Lords of Fortune that we can talk about later. That's a new faction in Thedas that I almost want to say is going to be what our new PC might be, a part of that.
Hmm.
So I will say, because we talked about these two so much, we talked about taking a little bit of time for Jordan to read the rest of them, and then we'll come back and talk about the others kind of in smaller chunks, because I feel like the rest of them don't need as much discussion as what we did with Dreadwolf and Hormak.
Yeah.
So,
there's not a lot of real estate, and so that I don't want to be too hard on Hormak or mm-hmm. any of the other ones that maybe seem like they're teases, or even some of the ones that are good stories but they're characters like you mentioned that aren't really going to show up again.
Mm-hmm.
There's only so much real estate. There's only so many characters that are truly the main characters of the series that you can mm-hmm. tell meaningful sort of macro plot level movement about, because you have to save some of that stuff for the game. So that's problematic, but I don't know. I don't want to be too hard on these stories. That's the position that they're in. You don't get to use the main characters, or you only get to use them in a way that's sort of reserved. So the Silent Grove trilogy in the comics, which we talked about a couple episodes back, I really love that because it's Alistair and Varric and his main characters doing cool shit, real shit,
mm-hmm.
not just being given side stories to hold us off. So... anyway.
Yeah, which is essentially what the other ones are.
if anything, this entire book is worth it for the Dreadwolf Take You. Honestly, it is, because it's some of the biggest chunks of storytelling we've gotten since DAI.
Mm. Which I at this point, we spoiled the whole thing, so I don't know why I'm bothering saying this now. But, there are some stories that reference other stories, but only, a very small, very quick, you won't even notice, probably. But the Dreadwolf Take You doesn't actually reference any of that. It doesn't reference any of the other stories. You could honestly just read the Dreadwolf Take You on its own, and it'd be fine. You will not get any you will not miss any context that you needed from the rest of the stories.
I cannot state this enough. That is a really well written short story. you mentioned it's not connected to the other short stories. I feel like I could hand that to someone who doesn't know jack shit about Dragon Age. I could give that to my girlfriend and be like, what do you think of this? And be like, oh, yeah, that was interesting how they were all in a room and had different perspectives, and the guy that they're looking... if you really think about it, if you don't know who Solas is, that short story communicates who he is well enough that you could just read it by itself.
That's fair, yeah.
Like,
I wonder if that's also, like, because in the future when the game comes out, they're probably going to have new players. So I wonder if this is, like, if you kind of want to know who he is.
Yes, that is exactly what it is. And that's why I'm so glad you mentioned that specific thing, because in order for the franchise to really, truly be healthy, there's always got to be new players and new fans coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great introduction to be like, look, if you want to jump into Dragon Age and you don't necessarily want to go play all these other games, this one short story, not even the whole novel, just this one short story is kind of a good indication of what the whole Solas plot is about going into DA4.
It really does, yeah. And like, I also want to say, like, there's two stories in this book, both written by Lucas Christiansen. I almost want to say my favorite because he made Aveline, but that are almost like nostalgic stories where, like, you played the games, or like, call back specifically, you played Dragon Age Inquisition, here's a bunch of characters that you probably remember, and at least maybe one or two of them you love, and this one plot hole that we kind of left open, and like, let's tie it all up, happy birthday. And then the whole time you're like, I remember, like, there's I feel like someone who didn't play the game and have like all those connections with the characters aren't going to get as much of the payoff as like someone like you haven't finished it yet, but like someone that I did. Like at one point, I don't want to spoil it for you, but at one point you find out what this thing is. You're like, oh,
yeah.
Oh no, I'm sad.
Well, you're 100% right, because even just like, you know, Charter, Sutherland, like, I'm like, oh yeah, them, right? Because like they have relatively minor roles in the game. But sort of getting to see them have their own story. In particular, again, I haven't finished Callback, but sort of Sutherland and his emotion to returning to Skyhold. Like, that's interesting. Because this,
yeah,
especially because you see that character, like the whole framing of his little mini quest line, a war table thing, is that he's a new person to the Inquisition and sort of young and inexperienced.
And further, I think it's also the character of Skyhold. It's like a send-off for Skyhold.
Yeah.
And like, it's really about protecting Skyhold. And, like, I feel nostalgic versus Skyhold. It's kind of like, oh, it's like that. It's very homey, you know, because you go there all the time. All your friends are there. You know, you do all your things there. So, like, it was very nice about that. And then Genitivi Dies in the End is like a love letter to everyone who just took a moment to read all the Codex entries. And I appreciate that so much.
Oh, that's cool. That's a great title, by the way. That's all when I saw that story, yeah. I'm like, that's a great fucking title.
It is, yeah. And it's just full of little, like, Easter eggs. Of, like, here's someone from the Codex entry. You know who it is. And I'm like, I do know who that is. So, yeah. And, like, it wasn't in a cheesy way, and it just made me smile, and I liked it a lot. It's probably one of my, like, top three or four stories in there, just because, like, it's just, I don't know, as someone who has took the time to read all the Codex entries out, which sometimes they slog, let's be honest. I felt redemption. I felt like the writer just looked at me and says, I know what you want. Here it is.
Oh, that's awesome.
Because it made me laugh. It was fun. It had a little bit of payoff. And like building up characters that you read their Codex entries and you can kind of get some personality. But here's like a little bit more of it. Here's them working together. Here's them reacting to one another. It was cute. It was cute. I liked it.
Bravo.
But those are completely different than Dreadwolf Take You, because Dreadwolf Take You, even if you have some attachment to Solas or you don't, like, you still get the message, where I think there's a lot lost on Callback and Genitivi if you don't know who they are. Like, there's probably going to be people where you read the, if you read the Genitivi Dies in the End, I bet you're going to look at me and go, who was these people?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, what was the point of, like, because there's definitely like, they, I don't want to spoil the twist, but they mention one specific Codex writer. And unless you know what she writes about, it, like, you don't kind of get the twist at the end. Because I don't think they explain it. Like, you kind of get what they're referring to, but you don't know how much it is.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, yeah. But I think those are the only two that really do that. I'm looking through the thing. Like, other ones I feel like are kind of more divorced from, like, the experience, like, the older experience of the games. But for the most part. But yeah, but we can talk about it later in the, which I actually would be curious. Do you want to have your girlfriend read Dreadwolf Take You and see what her reaction is?
Oh, that would be an interesting experiment.
So like, hey, did you like this? And would she just say like, oh no, I don't want to, because it is like, I don't know, probably like you know, 40 pages or something.
It's pretty accessible though. Yeah, that might be fun. Mm-hmm. I might report results on another episode if I do that. All right. Any other thoughts on at least on these two stories that we didn't already cover?
Not that I have. I'm sure like when I eventually make a video on it, I'm going to sit there for like an hour explaining something nitty gritty. But for right now, I think those are the basics. Those are the things I want to vomit out into the world.
Mm-hmm.
As I have the hiccups. But is there anything else that you want to say, or you're good?
I don't think I have anything else. I promised a little bit on sort of like structure and execution for Horror of Hormak, but it's just mainly nitpicking. It's not mm-hmm. bad. Again, the core of it is a pretty decent story, and I was interested in it. I do think that at small intervals, you know, Epler is a good writer, but he's not quite as good as Weeks. And I mean that with all due respect, but I just thought that some of the writing, some of the prose got in the way of the story sometimes. Mm-hmm. Nitpicky crap, really. But no, overall, I liked both stories. I thought that they were interesting. And I thought that each of them had some redeeming value as just standalone, although more so mm-hmm. for Dreadwolf.
Than Hormak.
Yeah.
All right. With that, we'll try to be better with podcasts getting out, but you know, things happen.
They do.
We didn't mean for that one to crash. It just,
we've only lost what, like maybe two episodes out of all the ones we've done.
Yeah, two or three maybe. I think they've all been my fault from various crashings or mic errors, but we'll figure that out. Yay, computer. All right. Well, with that, where can they find you?
The folks can find me at The Exalted March on YouTube, Twitter, and Instagram. Katie, where can the folks find you?
They can find me as Gilderthalen on Twitter and YouTube. And with that, everyone, pressure.